weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to Betta De Silva for driving us through the afternoon. It's Monday, the 23rd of September, and this is Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7 p.m, we'll be joined by Stephen Kelly and Paul Corey to reflect on a crazy Premier League weekend.
After a good opening weekend in the URC for Leinster, Munster and Ulster, Stephen Ferris will join us, but you could hardly say it was disappointing for Connacht either. And whilst Colin Walsh and Thomas Carty were victorious in Dublin, Anthony Joshua hit the deck in Wembley. So Gavin Cooney will be on the line to talk about all of that.
So you can get involved as well. You can text us on 51552 or on X at GameOn2FM or WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200.
Game On 2FM.
Welcome along. We are going to start this week with a very exciting competition. It's Monday. We all need a bit of a lift. So do listen closely, because if you're a football fan or love gaming, we've got a great prize for you today. EA Sports FC 25 is launching this Friday, and we're teaming up with EA Sports to give away a copy of the game every single day this week.
That's right. FC 25 is the highly anticipated follow-up to last year's hit, and this year they're bringing even more excitement with the return of the 10 SSC Airtricity Men's Premier Division teams.
And to celebrate the launch of EA Sports FC 25 this Friday, we're giving away a copy of the game every day. Plus, on Friday's show, we'll throw in an Ireland jersey with the final prize as well. To be in with the chance to win today, all you have to do is answer the following question. Which country won the FIFA World Cup in 2022? Was it England or Argentina?
Text your answer, name and email address to 51552 right now, and we'll announce the winner, if we do remember, before the end of the show. As always, RTE competition terms and conditions apply. See 2fm.ie for all the details.
Very exciting competition on a Monday, and you're right, Ruby, we will remember today. I know it's a really busy day. There was so much going on this weekend. Mondays are great when you have these brilliant weekends of sitting around watching sports. Paul Corey?
There was so much. I mean, Shamrock Rovers and Derry City on Friday feels like months
ago. Kicked it off, yeah, it does.
It feels like months ago, but plenty of sports. I actually thought the highlight from my perspective anyway was the golf. It kind of interrupted my first half watching of Man City and Arsenal because the playoff holes were coinciding with the kickoff of the game. But I just thought McIlroy was brilliant to manoeuvre himself back into playoff contention. His eagle on the 17th was amazing, and I actually thought the way he played the playoff holes was superb as well. It was just Billy Horschel was so good on the final.
Keeps happening to him, doesn't it?
He's been so close in so many competitions, and obviously in Down last week it was something similar. I guess the difference between Down and the three put on, I think it was 16 or 17. He almost threw it away. He put himself back into contention this week, and he was slightly unfortunate because on the final playoff hole Billy Horschel was able to get a bit of a read of the green, and he certainly took advantage of that. But McIlroy was brilliant, and it was a brilliant watch altogether, Marie.
Mere mortals like us, Paul Corey, can 3 and 4 putt regularly, but for a pro to 3 putt it does feel like you lose it. Whereas this weekend, I don't think Rory McIlroy lost. I think Billy Horschel won. I think there's a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And was it the first playoff hole when Billy Horschel went really close? No, it was the 18th of his actual round where he nearly went in on an eagle. Do you remember that, Ruby?
Mm.
That was superb. I mean, some of the play and some of the scoring is just so
ridiculous.
I'm
surprised you didn't turn over to the football, Paul.
I was flicking between the two.
Double screening.
Yeah, a bit. And I just, the golf was gripping me. I thought, like, Lawrence in particular probably should have gone on and won it. It finished with 2 par 5s. And for, like Ruby mentioned there, like mere mortals like ourselves, a par 5, if I got a par, I'd be absolutely delighted. But the way they play it, anything less than a bogey.
Ruby, we're doing the show a few years now. Are you getting any better at the golf?
Me, no. I have no intention of getting any better at golf either, Marie. I play golf purely socially and for fun, unlike some of my former colleagues who actually have aspirations to try and be golfers. I have absolutely none. I play for fun and I consider it a successful round, Marie, if I can start and finish with the same ball.
I genuinely thought when you retired and you started doing this programme and you were talking about playing a bit of golf, I thought you'd become obsessed with it and get really good.
No, definitely not get obsessed with it, unfortunately. Well, no, I would never get obsessed with it, but I think my kids are just the wrong age anyway. They're between 7 and 14, so you're absolutely flat out the whole time between ponies, football, soccer. To get 5 hours to go and play around the golf, it just doesn't happen.
Yeah, my dad played a lot of golf when we were growing up. He'd seven kids.
Oh my God. I've all the gear, but I'm absolutely useless.
Now, no, I didn't think that was protector.
He was a teacher. So you have a lot more time to go and play a few rounds of golf.
Possibly. You don't be dishing your dad telling us he wasn't at home looking after the seven you've either. Had you a highlight, Marie?
I did. I went to the Northern European Gymnastic Championships out in Sport Ireland, and it was the first time that I'd actually got to see gymnastics in person. Obviously saw Rhys at the Olympics and all his major medal competitions, and watched Simone Biles and the big stars, but I didn't ever see a competition. So I got to understand what it's all about and the different apparatus and the finals and the team events and all of that, and it was just amazing to see the athletes, how conditioned they were, how skillful they were. I just got a whole new appreciation of how difficult it is to nail any of the apparatus, whether it's the high bar or the beam or the vault. And what really blew my mind was that so many of them were brilliant on several apparatus. And I just thought, the amount of hours that these gymnasts have put in to be able to do what they're doing is just crazy.
The level of fitness, the core strength, to get that strong in your core, the level of fitness is off the charts.
Yeah, the rings, like I was sitting near the rings and the strongest gymnasts in the room were just...
Why was Rhys not competing?
He's taking a bit of time off, so he's going to compete again after Christmas, but he'd be at a higher level than a lot of those gymnasts. So he was watching the Pommel final and he loved watching. Rhys McLennigan was there and he was watching all of the finals, loves gymnastics, like loves just being a fan, kicking back, watching it, which was great as well. And I have to say, it was like being at a football match and standing near Lionel Messi, because every single person at that event wanted an autograph, wanted a picture. They were throwing shoes and apples and water bottles to get signed. Like it was just amazing to see it, because they're all, well, look, anybody that sees Rhys wants a, he's an Olympic champion, wants a medal. But just, I was blown away by the conditioning and the skill and the ability and the dedication of these athletes. And Ireland did really well as well. They had a historic couple of days and they had four medals for the women in particular. I just thought it was great to see. And hopefully the future looking bright for gymnastics when you have Rhys around inspiring you. No doubt
seeing,
it is.
Seeing is believing, Marie.
Yeah, but even the competitors there, like the guys that are hoping to someday compete against him at the LA Olympics, so a lot of them will make the step up now from a championship like this. It will take probably 4 years to get to that level, and for another 4 years of work, which is crazy as well. Like, they were all in awe of him too, and getting their pictures and getting things signed, and they all wanted to see the medal.
If they want to beat them, they can't idolize them.
Yeah, but they're only kids, like, you know, they're teenagers, so...
you just got to look them in the eye and think, someday I'll beat you.
And that is why you got to the stage you did in your career, Ruby. You're a cold-blooded killer.
Anyway, how about the football the weekend, Paul Curry?
Where do you start?
We started yesterday evening when you were watching the golf and everyone else was you and I were watching the golf and everyone else was watching Arsenal and Man City.
It was a spectacle, wasn't it? And probably not the spectacle everybody was expecting to see. And listen, there's obviously so much being spoken about the red card. I thought it was deserved. I don't know what Trossard is doing, particularly
well said,
particularly with what had happened in recent weeks with the Declan Rice sending off and the incident against Brighton. But from there on in, I thought Arsenal were superb in the way they defended. Yes, listen, Man City were poor in the ball. They didn't move it quite as quickly as they have done in recent weeks, and they probably got it wrong with the fact that Diaz and Akanji seem to be ending up with the majority of possession on the 18-yard box, and they're probably not two players that you want either looking to carve a defence open or get a strike off. So it was an enthralling watch. It wasn't probably the best sort of open game that we've ever seen, but it was certainly filled with plenty of drama.
Yeah, it was a great contest. That was the thing. Stephen Kelly is with us as well. Stephen, I thought that Arsenal were going to hang on. Like, at every attack that they foiled from Man City, they just seemed to be edging closer. And then they said, right, another 2 minutes added on. VAR had put it on, and I was just heartbroken for them.
Yeah, I can't really.
Well, you wouldn't be, obviously.
Yeah, I wasn't heartbroken. I wasn't heartbroken. No, I think they clung on and they defended. Like, yeah, you look at the two defenders and they're wonderful. They're so strong. They're so physical. But I think City, just they didn't have that way of unlocking them. And Paul's right, the people at Ginger Box that were trying to orchestrate were the two centre backs, that they're amazing players, but they weren't the ones that were going to unlock that defence. So City needed to change up. But you know, you look at City's dominance, was expected with Arsenal being a man down. They shot themselves in the foot. Trossard getting sent off, like, absolutely ludicrous decision, madness on his behalf to do that. After what happened with Royce, they can't have any complaints. But Arsenal have been showing us a really ugly side to their game that's really enjoyable to watch at times, because you kind of think, can you just see a game through? Can you defend? And can you be horrible? Can you do the things that you need to do to win something? And Arsenal has shown all those signs. Then they can go and I've seen them play teams off the park and obliterate teams in the first 20 minutes of the game, but they're passing in intensity in the forward area. So they're showing me both. It is just going to come down to that, those fine margins. But Rodri missing now for City, if he has done his ACL, that could be the difference. That really could be the difference. He is so pivotal for City, and he's such a key. So you kind of think that might make the difference for Arsenal, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I think that's all but confirmed that Rodri has done his ACL, and that was my worry, having, you know, there wasn't a huge amount of contact with the players, and you go down, you see him clutching the back of his knee, that has ACL written all over it. And
you'd know.
I certainly would. I could probably diagnose him, Marie, when he went down looking at him. So that could be a massive, massive loss for Man City. Just the record that they have when he's in the side. I can't remember when the last time he was, and he actually lost a game in 90 minutes, and he's so instrumental in how they play and linking the play, and also just screening that back four, back three, depending on the way they set up. So huge loss for Man City.
Who do you think, Tony O'Donoghue is with us as well. Tony, who's more important, Erling Haaland or Rodri?
Well, Haaland for getting the goals, but Rodri was the heartbeat of that team, really, isn't he? And I think he's going to be a massive loss. It's funny because Haaland has been scoring so many goals for Manchester City. Mm. It seems like it's the only way they can score goals. And that's weird because they were scoring goals from all different parts of the field, from midfielders, from fullbacks. They had a particular way of scoring a goal, getting to the end line and getting the ball across. But now it's just get it to Haaland and he'll do the finishing for them. He has a vast majority of their goals. It's almost as if they can't score without him. So if he was to suffer an injury and be out for any length of time, you'd wonder what they do, because they ended up yesterday doing what Stephen Kenny probably did and throw the big lad up into the box for the last few minutes when John Stones was sent up there, just basically to cause chaos, which is not what you'd have expected from a Pep Guardiola team. It's not a Pep Guardiola type tactic, and in a way Erling Haaland isn't a Pep Guardiola type player, but he's changed his style, it seems, in order to facilitate the big man. And well, he's repaying him with an extraordinary return, goals return, hasn't he?
Paul, I was shocked to hear John Stones say that his instructions from Pep were to go up and play off Erling Haaland. It was just the strangest thing. And then he was challenged on it and retreated a little bit and said, oh, you know, it's all very fluid and interchangeable. But what a strange tactic.
Yeah, it was. And it was probably getting to that stage of the game where they wanted to get as many bodies in the box and try, you know, get wide and deliver balls in and try cause as much chaos as you possibly could. But like to Stephen's point there, like it felt like it needed a change earlier on in the game. It felt like Diaz, Akanji and Walker was just overkill from a defensive point of view. Arsenal weren't able to get out of their half. I thought Grealish made a difference when he came on. I thought Savinho in general, his play while he was on the pitch was quite strong, and I just felt like the more players you had from an attacking perspective, the likes of your Phil Foden's, the more opportunities you would have to actually create chances. And it became very pedestrian, and they actually struggled a little bit against Inter Milan, Marie, during the week as well, when they played that low block as well. So it certainly is, you know, the way you set up when you play against Man City, particularly if you get a lead, you got to sit deep and you got to work hard and be disciplined in your shape. But they found an answer at the end of it. Yes, it came from a set piece and it was scrappy, but they still found a way. And in fairness to Man City, whether it's fluid or whether it's not, they keep going, they keep knocking on the door. And it was just very unfortunate from an Arsenal perspective how that goal actually came about.
Stephen, when John Stones even did score, all the red shirts just dropped. Heads down, shoulders down, body language down. They looked like they'd lost the World Cup final. Could there be a hangover from this?
I don't know what it'll be a hanger for. I think they'll just feel that if you said to Arsenal, you're going to go to Man City at this stage on the back of playing Tottenham, your Open League Champions League game, and then you have a seat on the weekend and you can come away with a draw, they'd snap your hand off for it. Like, at this stage of the season, absolutely put your hand. Just don't let them get too far ahead of you. So, yeah, they'll be devastated in that moment because of what's happened, because they've clung on. But when you look at the amount of chances, not clear for chances, but amount of, like, final third entries, passes, like, I don't, Timber and Havertz supposedly had 0% pass completion rate for the 89 minutes of the game, which is extraordinary. Two players. So you're going, so when you look back at it as a whole, in that moment, you're devastated. You're on the floor because you just, your blood, sweat, and tears try and keep them out, and they get a goal. It's a deflection, and you kind of feel hard done by. But when they look at the grand scheme of things, they think, we've gone to City, we're a man down, we're on the back of what it was, an away game at Tottenham, in a Champions League game, and Man City away, and we've come out with the points on board from that. It's only a plus. It has to be a plus for them.
Paul, to go back to Haaland for just a second, because we haven't actually mentioned him getting the ball and throwing it at Gabriel's head and he got away with it, but like, he's so petulant, and I know he was engaging in quite a lot of aggressive behaviour is probably a way to put it, and it seems to be a big part of his game now, this character that he's growing into almost.
Well, there's a lot of needle between the two sides, and you can see that in the way things are playing out. I wasn't a massive fan of his words to Arteta at the end of the game. I thought that was a bit of a low blow, and I don't mind the stuff between himself and Gabriel. I actually quite enjoyed it. It's nice to see a centre
half. Even the ball been thrown
at
his head.
It's probably not the greatest look, but I do enjoy a big centre half and a big centre four going at it between the two of them over the course of the 90 minutes. Haaland, in general, like, his record is ridiculous. I'm just looking at the Premier League here. Only Chelsea have scored more goals than Erling Haaland this season. He scored more goals than the rest of the sides within the division, and the first goal was so well worked. I mean, Savinho coming off the line, perfect touch. Thought he could have played a little earlier, but when he delivered that pass, the weight and the timing was excellent. Haaland held his run, and his finish looked so unorthodox. Like, he burst through with so much pace. He's able to stay away and keep distance between himself, Gabriel, and Saliba, and then he just composes himself and finishes so well beyond the goalkeeper. And for him and how he plays the game, like, he's not overly involved, his touches are always one of the lowest within the side, but when chances come about, I mean, he's just ruthless in front of goal, and he absolutely can be a difference maker between now and the end of the season for City.
That, of course, was his 100th goal for Manchester City. But as you said, Chelsea have the only team to have scored more goals than Erling Haaland. And Stephen, at the weekend, they scored 3. They probably could have scored 6. They were brilliant to watch.
They were fantastic. But Chelsea prediction is coming to fruition a year later, though.
But sure, look, it's like good wine. They're starting to mature.
It is. We talk about their squad and having... what they can bring off the bench, what they have at their disposal, it's a frightening mix of players, and it was just getting the right person to actually be able to say, no, I don't want you, and this is what I want, and you're going to be a part of my fans. Jackson, you know, you talk about a goal scorer that just needs confidence. His confidence is growing, and when he goes through, then the ball through the legs, the second finish, and Palmer's goal is unbelievable. Like, the way he hits that off the ball, it's just a sensational finish. But they ripped them apart. At times, they absolutely ripped them apart. West Ham didn't know what to do with them. West Ham is a team that have actually improved the season, and the players they've brought in, they've kind of, everybody they've added to this squad should have made them slightly better. But Chelsea, it was a non-game. It was a non-game for them. They absolutely ripped them apart. So you feel like Chelsea are in a position where, you know what, they could cause serious problems and have a really big say on what's going to be done towards the end of the season.
And Tony, huge credit then to Maresca, because there was a bit of concern about his lack of experience at that level and be able to manage all of those players that he has, but he seems to have been able to do it without any major issues arising.
He certainly does, yeah. And can he continue it for the rest of the season? You'd like to think he can, absolutely.
Yeah, he's been great, Paul, as a Chelsea fan, and I know you've been impressed, Paul.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I will hold judgment for now. I think there's a lot of football to be played. There's still probably a bit of a weakness in Chelsea's side that when kind of pressure comes, they can crumble at different times. But it was an impressive performance. I'd be a little bit worried about West Ham just on the basis of that performance. I thought they were so pedestrian. I mean, the first goal is like something you'd see in a Sunday league where they switch off, and it's a nice bit of interplay, but it's very simple, and Jackson seems to wander in from about 25 yards out and finish them off. But I guess what has been impressive in the last two games in particular is the Bournemouth game, when it became quite a 50-50 game, and it felt like it could go either way. Chelsea came out on top, and I think if that was 12 months ago, you probably would have seen them concede a sloppy goal in that instance, and the clean sheet against West Ham is certainly something to build on. But injuries is like injuries. Lavia played the first game, he's out injured again. Reece James has hardly kicked a ball in the last year and a half. Need to get some of those bigger players back fit, because they're going to need them as the season goes on. And Maresca's done quite well, but I think we should hold fire on that and give it a little bit more time before we make a proper judgment.
It's crazy that you just forget about a player like Reece James when he hasn't been around and he seemed so important
before. It's very worrying. Very worrying. Like, he was made captain at the beginning of last season, he's hardly kicked a ball since, and he seems to be having setbacks within his recovery. So I don't know, Marie. When will he be back? When he gets back, how many games is he going to play? I don't know.
Well, are all the Spurs fans in the room happy after the 3-1 victory over Brentford? Tony O'Donoghue?
Happy enough, yeah. I'm delighted that James Maddison got on the score sheet, because you know, he hadn't his best game in the previous home game against Arsenal. I'm glad that Brennan Johnson equally scored again, because he's been getting a bit of stick from the fans, which is absolutely abhorrent. I really think that's, you know, social media at its anti-social media worst. And Brentford had started the season quite well and played well against what you might call bigger teams, but I'm still waiting for Ange Ball to take off this season. And
we've lost Tony, so we can go to the other Tottenham Hotspur fan that is one's on
enough.
The line. Stephen Kelly,
yeah,
were you happy?
Enough, yeah. Yeah, Paul's surround the boys raging. No, I was happy. Yeah, it was a better performance, I think, as well. Going 1-0 down at home, I think the fans think, oh, the writing's on the wall here again, but they really performed very well. I think their all-round game, it wasn't dominant as in the all-out possession, which was actually kind of nice to see. We just attacked in really good numbers. And Maddison, it's his best game I've seen for a long time for Spurs. Great goal as well. You can see his confidence was growing as the game went on. But the one that's that Bentancur, I just think he, for me, is a player I just want to see him play regularly. I want to see him. He's on the back of some big injuries last season, and I think if you can get him up and running, I think he's a linchpin for them in the park. I really do. He can be such a catalyst for Tottenham doing good, because in the forward areas they've got a great mix, great balance of players, of youth, of, you know, experience. They've got Sonny, Maddison, Kulusevski, Solanke in there now, and Brennan Johnson. They've got players that can score goals and be a threat. But even Odegaard has come in, but they needed a player like Bentancur in the middle of the park to really solidify. I keep him fit, and I think he could be a huge, huge difference for them.
He most certainly could. Paul, Arnie Slot is back on a winning thread with Liverpool, 3-0 winners over Birmingham. Diaz with 2, Nunez with 1, and never looked in doubt, did it?
No, it didn't, and it was much more like Liverpool as opposed to the performance that we saw against Nottingham Forest. What I love about their game, Ruby, and it's starting to annoy me a bit watching some of the teams, like if you look at Brentford in the first goal they gave away against Tottenham trying to play out from the back, you could see it then in the Fulham and Newcastle game, Fulham trying to play out from back when they're ahead and just coughing up possession in their own 18 yard box. It's absolutely ludicrous. What Liverpool do so well is they're more than happy to mix the game up. If you look at the Diaz goal, his first one, Konate, a good long ball over the top, a willing runner, and you're in, and they have that in abundance at the top end of the pitch, and they were really, really strong. I mean, the Nunez goal was brilliant. The little interplay between himself and Salah was excellent, and it was absolutely what Arnie Slot would have wanted from a Premier League perspective. And it was also great to see Quaven Kelleher keep a clean sheet. He had one ropey moment with the ball at his feet, but other than that, I mean, he pulled off two fantastic saves. It was one quick reaction save, and then there was another one where the ball came off the crossbar, ricocheted against Trent, and he managed to keep it out. So it was a great day at the office for them. I think the fact that Diaz is up and running, Salah looks really sharp, Nunes back on the score sheet, they seem to have those same sort of weapons that they had under Klopp. So much energy, so much pace, so much enthusiasm, and they just seem to have a bit more balance now in the middle of the park, and Ryan Gravenberch is certainly somebody who stood out for me.
Stephen, Trent Alexander-Arnold has been garnering a little bit of attention over the last 24 hours because of his comments where he really endorsed Arne Slot and said he was delighted to have a manager that's challenging him and allowing him to be the player that he can be. And if people are interpreting as a bit of a dig at Jurgen Klopp, what do you think?
I don't. I think Trent and Jurgen Klopp had an unbelievable relationship. I think he brought him into the team he's the one that gave him his debut. I don't take that at all. I just think that he's trying to get behind this manager. what will be a bigger endorsement to Arnie Slot is if Trent signs a new contract. that'll be the only one that will convince me that he's going to stay, because Liverpool fans are going to hate to hear this. I'm sure you're going to hate to hear this, but I think he has got Real Madrid written all over him. Imagine him playing balls into Vinicius and Mbappe and Rodrigo running off him. Like, I just kind of picture him in the white. I wouldn't want to see him leave the Premier League because he's a rare talent. He's just a sensational footballer. His technical ability is out of this world. And I enjoy it while it lasts. Like, listen, you can say whatever you want about defensively, but it doesn't faze me. As someone who prided myself defensively, I wouldn't care. He's just so good on the ball.
Yeah, it's a wonderful idea for Trent Alexander-Arnold. I hope he's listening. Heads off to
Real Madrid myself. As well, maybe, on the way.
Paul Curry, Villa, look, it's going to be a big year for them in Europe, Champions League football, etc., etc. But they're sitting third in the Premier League and they're relegated Wolves to the bottom.
And they've come from behind again, and it was another really entertaining game, and it was another game in which John Duran comes off the bench and scores, and you start to wonder, how much longer can you keep this man on the bench? Because some of the goals that he's scoring and his return is absolutely phenomenal from the beginning of the season. But it was a game, I guess, you don't really know, particularly with the likes of Aston Villa. We saw it with Newcastle last year, how difficult it was to balance Champions League football, and you wonder what sort of performance you're going to get. And one of the goals they gave away was actually a really poor kind of mistake from trying to build up from the back again. But certainly enough goals and enough creativity in the final third to kind of galvanise themselves and get back into the game. And you listen to Unai Emery afterwards, he said he was kind of much more happy with the second half performance, and I won't say what he said about the first half performance, he wasn't exactly pleased with it. But it's really important for them, I think, to keep Ollie Watkins scoring. You could see kind of at the tail end of last year when the goals dried up, that kind of coincided with Villa not picking up as many points as they have done recently. And Morgan Rodgers, who they signed from Middlesbrough last year, had a really good finish to the end of last season and looks a real player in that number 10 position.
I was keeping an eye on the Irish, particularly Jake O'Brien for Everton and Evan Ferguson as well for Brighton. But that Brighton Forest game, Tony, just seemed like an absolute cracker, one that had everything.
Yeah, I watched quite a bit of that yesterday afternoon, and it was a great finish, wasn't it? Yeah. Forest have surprised me last season as well. Nuno Espirito Santo got the red card in this one. The Brighton manager, Hulsler, got the red card as well. It was a game that had everything. I think yesterday afternoon's football was absolutely fascinating. Enjoyed watching Nottingham Forest and Brighton. Evan Ferguson didn't get much opportunity, really, to show anything. He came on, he hardly touched the ball, to be honest with you, but it's good to see him at least back in the squads, and ideally he'll get starting minutes pretty soon.
Yeah, well, he must be coming on, Tony, like physically coming on, the fact that he is coming off the bench, or is it a case that it's just going to be really hard to get into that team?
I just wonder if does the new manager trust him enough. There was, you know, obviously a huge amount of hype around him, and then he had the injury. So we'll have to wait and see if he gets those minutes. But yeah, he's in the squad. He was put on late. But as I say, if he can keep getting those minutes in the legs, ideally he should be starting. Ideally he plays 90 minutes and gets back on the goal sheets as well.
What about Jake O'Brien at Everton? Is he making progress, do you think?
Well, again, unless you're starting in the team, I mean, you know, playing the Carabao Cup or the secondary competitions is not what we expected for someone to go for a significant fee. You'd really like to think, but he's, you know, Everton are struggling, so what does Sean Dyche do? But, you know, Jacob Bryan showed in France, and even on international duty, he's got what it takes. But Sean Dyche has yet to be convinced of that, it would seem. We need our players playing regularly. We need our players starting in the Premier League and as high up as possible in the Premier League for their careers to flourish.
Paul, if there's one Irish player flying at the moment, it's surely Adam Ida, is it?
Yeah, it is. Adam Ida, Liam Scales, particularly with their adventures in Europe during the week, and the fact that both players were on the score sheet is huge. And actually, we were speaking last week, like, Liam Scales is absolutely somebody who should be starting for Ireland at this moment in time. He can play a number of positions, left back, left wing back. He could definitely slot into one of them. And Adam Ida, yeah, I'm always a little hesitant to get too excited about Scottish football now that Meath are playing at the top for Celtic, because I think you should score goals in that team. They dominate games. They probably have 70-75% of possession. But I think it's a real positive for him. And the reason I say that, Ruby, is because Adam Eda's general game is quite strong. His hold-up play is good. His pace, he's powerful. He can get in behind teams. His finishing hasn't always been something that has looked very natural. And maybe with the number of chances he's getting at Celtic, the minutes that he's getting under Brendan Rodgers, maybe we'll see him just go up a level.
Yeah, that'd be
great. Practice does make perfect.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to say goodbye to Stephen Kelly, because we're going to chat about the League of Ireland now. Stephen, thank you so much. Paul, stay with us. Tony O'Donoghue, are you in Tala for the Bowes Shamrock Rovers game?
I am, and if I dropped out there a while ago, I apologise. I think it's when all the other reporters came to the press box area and turned on their Wi-Fi. Perhaps that's what did for me. But yeah, we're about 70 minutes to 75 minutes to kick off. Bohemians are out walking around the pitch. They're ready not just for their proper warm-up, but just having a look at what is the best venue in the country. There's no doubt about it. And it's going to be a huge venue for Shamrock Rovers over the next few weeks, because they're going to be here a lot. They have tonight's game, obviously. Then they have home to Pats. Then they've got Apoel in the conference. And then they've got Shelburne. So their next away game isn't until the 18th of October in Drogheda. So if they can make this place a fortress, if they can, get results, get wins here, including in the Europa, it'll change the nature of their season. Now, obviously, what happened up in Derry on Friday has still a lot of anger around here. Stephen Bradley was very angry. What happened, of course, was very, very late in the game. A penalty awarded to Derry for what looked on TV replay, certainly, as that there was no contact. And Stephen Bradley thought it was a disgrace. He called out the referee on it. The penalty was scored by Patrick Hooban. So the spoils shared, if you like. But it would have been a huge blow to Derry psychologically, because Derry came out of it thinking, gosh, we've got a point. And continues their pursuit of Shelburne, and they have Shelburne to come to the Brandywell as well, and Rovers, is it still likely that they could possibly turn around the deficit and retain their title? Looking less likely. The last time Bowes and Rovers met here in Tala, that was last March, and it was a huge occasion. I think it was the biggest crowd ever at this venue, over 10,000 people. So it is the biggest Dublin derby. Rovers won that one 3-1. In fact, they tend to win at home against the Hoops. But, since then, the games have gone in a different direction. The Gypsies have had the upper hand. There was a draw in Dalymount Park in May. Then Bohemians won in the FAI Cup, and then they won the league earlier on this month. That was the what they're calling the Coldplay kickoff. Remember, that was the 11:30 kickoff. So, that's Bowes' only win in 8 league games, and then they lost to Drogheda on Friday. So they're in danger of possibly dropping into relegation playoff territory. They have to really be careful. But, some Rovers people think that this is their cup final. Well, Bowes are still in the FAI Cup, and they might have a cup final appearance to come. And there's no love lost between these two, as you know. Shamrock Rovers objected to Dawson Devoy being in that cup-winning team, and their objection was overturned. Rovers still deciding what to do with that. It's going to be a cracker tonight, I think. And it's always sparking anyway, this particular fixture, and I think it will tonight as well. And I've just got the team news, by the way. So 2 changes for Shamrock Rovers from the side that drew 1-1 up in the Brandywell. So it looks like a simple swap. The 2 wing-backs, Trevor Clark and Dara Burns, come into the side in place of Honahan and Ferrugia. Otherwise, it's the same 11 that started against Derry. And 3 changes for Bohemians. Paddy Kirk comes back in. Adam McDonald comes back and captains the side. He's in for Jordan Flores, who's suspended, and Jevon Mills is in the side as well. So it's a 7:45 kickoff here at Tala. It's Shamrock Rovers against Bohemians. I'll probably get abused for this, but I'm calling it the biggest Dublin derby, certainly the most attended.
Tony, thank you so much. Great stuff. as always. Paul Curry, does anybody want to win at this league? You see Shell slipping up again at the weekend. One win in their last seven games.
Well, I think it's eight. I think it's 1-8, Marie, and they're in free fall at the moment. I mean, the fact that they've only scored 32 goals in 30 games, they're not keeping the same sort of clean sheets, you'd be worried for them. And if Shamrock Rovers had actually won on Friday night, I think there would have been a belief in Tallaght that they have enough in them to close the gap. I just feel now it's probably not enough games left for Shamrock Rovers to kind of see it through, particularly given they're going to have to balance Europe. I would say Derry would be my tip.
Okay, thank you so much. We're going to take a really quick break. Do stay with us. We will be looking back at the URC opening weekend, and also we'll be reflecting on what's next for Anthony Joshua.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. We are turning our attention to rugby. I'm delighted to say that Stephen Ferris joins us now on the line to reflect on the opening weekend of the URC. And Stephen, I read a good stat on the RTE website. After 41 tries scored, there was a combined total of 12 points separating 12 teams across six fixtures, as no side won by more than a score. You can't ask for any more than that, can you?
No, you certainly can't. It was unbelievable, ridiculous, actually. And Cardiff sitting top of the table, who would have thought it? At the end of round one, another South African teams, they didn't play because of Currie Cup commitments. But yeah, it was a very entertaining opening round of the URC. And I suppose if you watch the Munster Connacht game and some parts of that Ulster Glasgow game, you know, the teams looked good for maybe 5 or 10 minutes and then just went off the ball. And, you know, there was line breaks and lots of missed tackles. Like, Connacht's success rate of tackling was only 80%. Like, so, you know, missing one out every five is really, really tough away from home against a Munster side. But they still nearly managed to sneak over the line, only getting beaten by a couple of points. So, yeah, it makes for entertaining rugby, that's for sure. But I think it's all going to start to tighten up over the next few weeks once the teams get a grip on things and you know, a few of the rock stars start to roll back in.
Yeah, look, they will tighten up. But even if you look at Munster and Connacht, yes, there was a conversion in it, but the yellow card after Connacht were leading 12-0 seemed to be the big difference. But what about their halfbacks, Murphy and Nuani? They were looking electric.
Yeah, Ben Murphy was awesome, wasn't he? And we were interviewing Richie Murphy, obviously his dad, Ulster head coach, after the game, and he said his phone was going mad in his pocket, so he knew that his son was going pretty well in that game, but he hadn't yet to see it. So yeah, he was outstanding, he really was. And Keelan Blade, come on, who's been brilliant for Connacht over the last couple of years, and made a couple of mistakes. And you know, Josh Iwani, who was very good for the most part, he hit the post with a penalty, missed touch right at the end to give themselves a chance of winning the match. So lots and lots of positives, but still a few things to tighten up. And it's good that the halfbacks went really well, especially with JJ Hanrahan and Jack Carty not available for selection. So yeah, entertaining match between those two, and Munster will be more than happy, a bit like Ulster, not playing to their full potential and you know, getting the right result.
Yeah, it's always good to see the big players, the stars back, as you mentioned earlier. Mac Hansen returning after that long-term injury as well.
Yeah, it was awesome, wasn't it? I know there was a bit of chat about, you know, him and Santiago Cordero playing together for the first time. I think Cordero only played two games for Connacht last season, but he was probably the most disappointing player on the pitch for Connacht, actually, and possibly playing out of position and playing fullback rather than wing. But Mac Hansen, every time he touched the ball, it just looked like, you know, he was going to make a half break, or, you know, there's a couple of ridiculous offloads which led to busts and line breaks for Connacht. So yeah, he looked like he hasn't been away for too long, and it's great to see. And from an Irish perspective, I suppose all the Irish fans want to see him, you know, tog out in the November internationals, and hopefully he can stay fit and get a run of games for Connacht.
Stephen, you were in Kingspan. As an Ulster fan, did you see a difference from last year?
No, I definitely didn't see a difference in the first game. Again, with their new halfback, well, Nathan Doak's been there for a while, but Aidan Morgan stepping into the 10 position. There wasn't the usual Stuart McCluskey to give them the vocal point in the middle of the pitch, so they had Jude Postlewaite and Stuart Moore in the centres. And again, just to touch on Richie Murphy, like he said after the game, you know, the first 50 minutes, it almost looked like they didn't know what they were doing. You know, the players didn't know what they were doing on the pitch. And, you know, I said at the end of the game, it almost felt like there was a robbery in Belfast, like, because Glasgow played so well and made numerous busts and were physically dominant. And every time they carried the ball, they made 5, 10, 15 yards. And every time Ulster carried the ball, they were getting pumped backwards. And then ended up having to kick possession away or make a mistake or give away a penalty. And somehow, Ruby, I've commentated on a lot of Ulster matches over the years. They find a way just to dig in. I don't know, it's just ignorance, pure ignorance that, you know, they're in their home turf and they refuse to roll over. And, you know, that's a sign of a team that's got a little bit about them. And, you know, fair play, they dug in there for 55 minutes. I think it was Tom Jordan, the guy, again, a soft enough yellow card. I thought personally a penalty would have been suffice. But, and the game just sort of turned on that. And young Dave Shanahan come on a scrum half and the tempo just lifted, the crowd got behind them, and before you know it, they get a score and they just go after them. And, you know, the last play of the game, it was enough to get them the win.
What would you like to see, or maybe in what ways would you like them to evolve now? Like, having something about them and being able to grind out the wins is great, but what do they need? What extra do they need?
Look, Maria, like, if they play the same way they did at the King's Band at the weekend over the next 6 weeks, I don't think they would get the right result. And of course they're playing defending champions in Glasgow and they had a pretty good side out. But for me with Ulster is that I feel like teams are very comfortable holding on to possession against them, and the stats don't lie. At the end of last season, I think Ulster make you work really hard, but ultimately you do end up scoring against Ulster. So, you know, it's just all about keeping going when you have the ball, and Ulster don't go after the breakdown that much. They don't put in huge dominant tackles. So, you know, the attack's never retreating that much. And that's what I would like to see from Ulster, just being, they have the energy there. They have the accuracy most of the time. They just don't have the brunt and the brute force to make a huge collision that can change a second or a moment in the game and, you know, create that turnover or create that brilliant counter ruck, or and that's just something that's been lacking. I think under Dan McFarland, their defence was very, very shaky, and then towards the end of the year, it got a lot better. And I thought for the most part last night, they worked extremely hard, especially when they were retreating, so in a scramble defence. So yeah, I know I'm getting into the more specifics here, but like for Ulster, it's just about building on what they had last year. And if you say, what do you want to see, Stevie? I just want to see an improvement. You know, Richie's brought them so far, but they got to keep getting better, and that's across every aspect of their game. But for me personally, just a little bit more in their defence to put teams under pressure.
They're going to have to do something. Do you think there is a player or two players to come back in there that can make those tackles, make those breaks? Obviously, Stuart McCluskey is missing, but have they got someone that's not in that pack that can change a game?
Yeah, I think Cormac Isichukwu, who come on like is a serious operator. He come on in the second row. He was brilliant last year in the quarterfinal of the URC against Leinster. Went off with an HIA, and the game just seemed to just change. It almost felt like Ulster's chances went out the window as soon as that man went off. And I know there's been a lot of chat about him, and he's sort of lived up to the hype so far. So, like, he is an extraordinary athlete. He really is. He was out injured for quite a period of time. And if he can stay fit, and I would love to see him play in the back row, Harry Sheridan and Ian Henderson in the second row, or Kieran Treadwell in the second row, and get that big back row, Nick Timoney probably at number 8, and Dave McCann. And I think that's the best sort of back five in their pack that they can have. The worrying thing, as always, is that, you know, if you don't have a platform in the front row when it comes to set piece, you're always going to be under the pump. And you know, Corey Barrett, Eric O'Sullivan and John Andrew there against Glasgow certainly give away 3 or 4 penalties in the first half, and you just won't be able to do that in a big game. So yeah, I can't name one individual that's going to completely turn that around, but there's a couple of guys, McCann and Isichukwu, that certainly have the ability to do so.
10 tries in the Leinster Edinburgh game, Stephen, but Leinster coming out on top, but Edinburgh made them work for it.
Yeah, they sure did. It was good to see. Like, I like to see the way Leinster went behind. You know, they went behind. They had to work for it. They got back in 12 all at halftime. Again, Dave Cherry scores a try. And they have to work for it again. Leinster scrum was under the pump a bit. They, you know, their maul defence, they won't be happy with that. But Gibson Park was superb. Man of the match once again. His try in the 53rd minute. It sort of knocked the stuffing out of Edinburgh. And then, you know, shortly after, Jack Conan got the try. And that was the game sort of done and dusted on 60 minutes. I know Edinburgh fought really, really hard to get back. And you know, Duan van der Merwe and... I'm not sure who scored the last one, but you know, they got themselves 2 points out of the game, and you know, up against Leinster with the team that Leinster had. Would you want more at home at the Hive in Edinburgh? Of course you would, but 2 points isn't a bad result for Edinburgh, and you know, Leinster will be looking to improve as well in that game.
Okay, well, it is only the opening weekend, so lots more to come, and great to have you back for these Monday debriefs as well. Thank you, Stephen. We're going to take another break and then we're back with boxing.
Game On 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. So it was a big weekend of boxing as well last weekend, and Gavin Casey of the 42 joins us on the line. Do you start in the Three Arena or start in Wembley? I suppose Wembley, Anthony Joshua, is it all over for him?
You know what, competitively I would say yes. I've always been a little bit uncomfortable suggesting that a boxer should retire, because I ultimately think, particularly in the case of Joshua, this is an intelligent adult man we're talking about. He can make his own decisions either competitively or commercially, however he sees it. But I think it is tough to see a way back for him to the very apex of the sport, where he has probably done well to remain over the last 3 or 4 years and recovering from defeats. I just think the road back from this one is especially uphill. And when you see a fella who's in his early to mid 30s get absolutely flatlined like that, as he was by Daniel Dubois, it's tough to make the case for him responding to it or rebounding from it, I should say. And it's probably tough to justify the continuation of a career which has already yielded hundreds of millions of pounds. And you'd much rather see a guy be able to speak properly in 10 or 15 years' time than go back to the well again. But I expect that he will exercise his rematch clause and look to fight Dubois again and look to nullify some of the mistakes that he made the first time around. So ultimately it'll be his call. But I wonder, will there be the same appetite in general to see him back out there after this one? I somehow doubt it.
When you mentioned the hundreds of millions, I didn't feel as sorry for him as I did at the time. But Dubois was excellent, and I think that maybe he's not getting as much credit for the performance, because we've just been so fascinated for so long with Joshua and what he was going to do and what he was capable of, or not, as it seemed on this occasion. But Dubois seems like he's a real talent, Gav.
Yeah, and what a story it is, because you go back less than 4 years, Daniel Dubois was beaten by Joe Joyce, another longtime heavyweight contender from England, and Joyce just peppered him with the jab all night to the point that he broke his orbital bone, and Dubois was obviously in agony. It's an excruciating injury to suffer in any sport, not to mind in boxing where it's been repeatedly targeted. Dubois took a knee, he quit, and I'd have no bones about saying that. He quit in the ring, and I thought it was absolutely the correct decision to quit. Preserve yourself for future nights. At the time, he was only 23, 24, and he has come back and absolutely excelled as he enters his kind of physical prime, probably his psychological prime as an athlete as well. And look what he produced on Saturday night. And it kind of makes a mockery of these people who take against boxers who do take a knee or quit on their stool or whatever and look to preserve themselves, because he now is right at the very top of the heavyweight division, whereas 3.5-4 years ago people were saying he has no heart, he doesn't have it in him to become a champion. He, as we clearly saw on Saturday, he does. And you mentioned his talent, Ree. He is exceptionally talented. He's probably a little bit more heavy-handed than Joshua. I would say the first right hand that knocked Joshua down probably knocks out most heavyweights, and Joshua actually did well to remain in the fight from that point onwards to a degree. But this guy's the real deal, Daniel Dubois, and at 27 you could make the case for him getting even better in future months and future years. He'll have his eyes set on things bigger and better than Joshua now. He's going to look at the winner of Tyson Fury and Alexander Usyk's rematch. Usyk already has a stoppage win over Dubois, which is kind of contentious because Dubois knocked him down really with what looked to be a legitimate body shot. The referee awarded it as a low blow and allowed Usyk to recover, but he'll be looking for revenge from Usyk or an even bigger all-British heavyweight fight with Tyson Fury. And Joshua is kind of frozen out of that picture for the time being, which is why I'm saying at this juncture of his career, it's a pretty long road back.
Yeah, it really is. Gav, we're out of time, I'm afraid, so we'll have to get you back on to reflect on the other boxing on Friday night. But really appreciate you taking the time before we finish up. We have our competition winner for the EA Sports FC 25 for today, and the winner is Graeme Devlin, who he gave us the correct answer of Argentina as the nation that won the FIFA 2022 World Cup. And if you missed out today, don't worry, tune in tomorrow. There'll be another chance to win a copy of EA Sports 25. So that's it from us for this evening. Thank you to Paul for coming in, John producing, Laura Lee, the BCO. We'll be back tomorrow.
I'm back tomorrow, Marie.
Yep, we'll be going through lots more of the weekend sport and what's coming up as well.